This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the health benefits of complex formulations with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll learn how to change your relationship with time with mindfulness expert and author Alex Snyder. We'll find out how having an empty nest is like getting a fresh start with author Chantal Bisson. And lastly, we'll discover the challenges of getting access to medication with patient Lisa McColeman and Dr. Rick Adachi. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Researchers at the University of Bristol have discovered that regular moderate exercise may improve heart health in a new way by changing the nerves that control the heart. The study, published in Autonomic Neuroscience, found that exercise reshapes these nerves differently on the left and right sides of the body. Using advanced imaging, researchers studied rats after 10 weeks of aerobic exercise. They found the number and size of nerve cells changed in different ways on each side of the body. These nerves help control the heart's speed and rhythm. The findings could help explain why some treatments for heart conditions, such as irregular heartbeats, chest pain, and stress-induced broken heart syndrome, work better on one side of the body than the other. In the future, doctors may be able to target treatments more precisely. Researchers cautioned that the study was carried out in rats, so more research is needed before the findings can be applied to people. The next step is to study whether the same changes occur in humans and how they affect heart function during exercise and at rest. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings, and he's also a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, Gordon. How are you doing?
Great, Jamie. Thanks for having me on again.
So year over year, my health, you know, we have peaks, we have valleys, and the things that I'm doing now are things that I didn't do 5-10 years ago. It's a whole brand new world for me. One of the things I'm noticing, Gordon, is that the number of supplements I take on a daily basis has increased. So right now, every day I'm taking calcium, D, B12, probiotic, magnesium, omega-3, and K. But I'm wondering, instead of taking all these individual supplements, I'm wondering if I should be doing something different, if there's a different solution. And I think we're going to talk about more complex formulations today, right?
For sure. I've been in this industry now for 30-something plus years.
Yep.
And one of the things that has always struck me about this industry, our industry, is that everybody, every week, every month, you'll hear somebody come out and say, I have the new magic pill that cures everything.
Yep.
All right?
Yep.
And I'm always skeptical when I hear that. And the reason for that is because there is no, in my mind, there's no one thing that you can take that cures everything. All right. I mean, if I look at things like bone density, osteoporosis, etc., everybody says you take calcium, right? But what they don't realize is that calcium alone, even if you just took calcium and nothing else, it is not going to do the job, because the physiology of bone formation, the biochemistry of bone formation, tells me that you require much more ingredients to make a piece of bone, or to thicken up the bone, right? So it always never made sense to me that you would just say take calcium. We're getting more and more enlightened, because now I see people who've taken calcium. There's vitamin D incorporated in the calcium, and there's some magnesium incorporated with that. But that in itself, whilst it's a little bit enlightened, it is not the only thing that you should be looking at. Because something as simple as what you would do, you take the calcium because that's a major one of the major structural components of bone. But if you only take calcium, yes, it might build your bone, but then it makes your bone brittle, right? So what's the sense of having extra bone if it's brittle? Because if you just whack it somewhere, it'll fracture to a gazillion pieces. Now I'm overblowing this gazillion pieces a bit, okay? But it will fracture. Then you need other components. You need things like zinc. You need things like boron. You need things like silicon. All those help build flexible, stronger bone, right? So you need to take something with a lot of other trace minerals in there. The vitamin D that you take also serves a purpose. What it does, it helps incorporate the calcium and the other minerals, help incorporate into something called the extracellular matrix, which becomes bone. But where I'm going with this is that I'm trying to say that it is just not one magic component that you take to get you strong bones. All right. So even some things you need protein to help with this process, because part of your extracellular matrix is protein, right? So you need all of these ingredients to come in. And my philosophy over the years has always been, there's not one magic component. You've got to take a formulated product that has many different ingredients in there. The downside of many different ingredients is that it's not one single pill. You might have to take about three or four pills at the same time, or you might have to take it as a powder, or you might have to take it as a liquid, right? So you can get all of it into one, right? And I think for the person who is taking the supplements, sometimes it's better to take one scoop of something as opposed to taking 10 different pills from 10 different bottles. Like for when I look at you, you're taking calcium, D, probiotics, magnesium, and all those other things. There's about six or seven different pills that you have to take all at once. It would be much easier to take one scoop of something, mix it in water, mix it in your favorite beverage, and just drink it,
Yeah,
right?
I mean, the advantage I have is that my wife lays out my pills for me, except for the probiotics, which are in the fridge. She can't lay them out the night before. But if she wasn't around, to your point, it's work to organize yourself and make sure you're taking all the pills all the time.
All the time, right? And so sometimes if you have is one formulation has everything, right? But you got to take it in a large enough quantity that it actually makes a difference.
And we're relying on your expertise, right? Because you're formulating these and you're understanding, even with the trace minerals that you were explaining about, like zinc and boron, et cetera, like how much of those need to go into the formulation and how much our bodies need. Like that's
And
that's
unfortunately,
yeah.
I was just going to say, fortunately, we live in North America and in the Western economies. Let's face it, none of us are really starving, right?
Yeah.
And so none of us are really nutrient deficient. What we may be is a little bit deficient in one ingredient versus another ingredient, but all in all, we have most of the ingredients. It's just that we need a little bit extra, because as we grow older, we don't eat as much. We don't eat the same variety of food as much. So we need to get a lot of these components from a supplement source.
Well, sure. I mean, I think it is an age issue and our abilities to metabolize these nutrients. Number one, I agree with you there. I'm wondering about the North American, like when your reference to the North American diet, I would say, yes, it's true. We're not living in a country where people are starving generally. However, I think it's actually the reverse. I think people aren't eating well at all because they're eating hyper-processed foods. And I'm wondering, how, like when I go shopping and I see what people are putting on the little conveyor belt, like it, to me, I'm wondering where they're getting their nutrients at all. Like I know I'm eating salad. I know I'm eating meat. I know I'm eating fish and eating all those great things. But I don't know what other people are eating.
Well, I agree with you there, right? And I, when I was thinking of the North American society, I'm thinking about me. I try to eat as well as I can.
Yeah.
All right. And I'm as guilty as everybody. I will indulge in ultra processed foods every so often, right? But I try to minimize my intake of ultra processed foods or even of processed foods in general, right? Like for example, I know when I eat a cheeseburger, all right, they slap on the processed cheese thing.
Yeah.
Versus if I was doing it at home, I'd probably cut myself a piece of cheddar and put the cheddar on my hamburger. Right.
Yep.
That alone makes a huge difference as far as your nutrient intake gets.
Well, all the smash burger places around the city are definitely putting processed cheese on there. And if you're a purist, if you want a smash burger, or like if you're trying to imitate a smash burger at home, which my kids have forced me to do on occasion, well, on a flat top, we're using the processed cheese, even though I know you're correct that real cheese is better. So circling back to like the formulations, what goes into it? Like when you decide that you're putting something together.
My philosophy in formulations is as follows. I always, my mantra is that there are many ways to the top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And so no matter what we're trying to formulate, most of the ingredients work on the body to get the same result, but through different mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the concept of many ways to the top of the mountain. And the reason for that is because sometimes your people have a biochemical blockage somewhere that this particular ingredient won't work. Well, if there are other mechanisms involved, the other ingredients will help you get the same effect, even though one of your paths are blocked. Mm-hmm. So this is why we have many different ingredients in the same product. And somebody will say to me, but Gordon, for example, use our liver flush product as an example. Mm-hmm. The idea with the liver flush product is to increase the metabolism of the liver, right? Help protect the liver from the effects of free radicals. But and somebody will say to me, but Gordon, I can use milk thistle and it will increase the metabolism of the liver. I say, yes, you can do that, right? However, what happens if your body doesn't work with milk thistle? So this is why our liver flush product, we have milk thistle, but we also have things like glaucurium and a whole bunch of other herbs specifically targeting the liver tissue.
Can we shift gears a bit? I want to talk about cost effectiveness. Do you feel that for the consumer, these formulations are actually more cost effective than not having the formulations?
It is definitely more cost effective because the processing and the packaging alone will save you a whole bunch of money. All right, because let's say you take zinc. Mm-hmm. The quantity of zinc you need on a daily basis is probably anywhere from 10 milligrams to maybe 30 milligrams or more, right? Mm-hmm. A little bit more. But you're within that ballpark range most of the times.
Looking at it from the consumer side again, how do we know about issues such as which brand we should trust and quality measures and whether or not they're actually sort of putting the right amount of those trace minerals into the products that they're formulating?
20, 30 years ago, I would say it was a crapshoot, right? Because everybody said their quality was the best. Okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Today, though, with Health Canada, we have to get a site license. We have to get a NPN number, right? With the site license and the NPN number process, you need the control a lot of the manufacturing, right? Mm-hmm. So, you have to get the site license renewed now. It used to be, it's once every 3 years for us as a company. That's a maximum anybody can get, once every 3 years renewal. But because of that renewal process and because of all the oversight by Health Canada, most manufacturers, if not all, are legit,
yep,
right? By today's standards, all right? So what you should be looking at is what you're getting, how much of what you're getting, cost effectiveness, right? Those are some of the things. The problem with us is that also the education level of a lot of these things, people talk to their friends and their friends say, you got to take magnesium. You got to take calcium. So what do? They go run out and they buy magnesium and they go run out and they buy calcium without the full story of realizing, I got to take magnesium with calcium, vitamin D, zinc, copper, silicon, all that together to get the best bang, to get the best effect,
Right.
right? If you're looking for if you're looking for bone growth or osteoporosis. So,
What about buying stuff online and perhaps it's manufactured overseas, where
those I would take with a grain of salt. I mean, not to badmouth anybody who manufacture for overseas, because there are overseas manufacturers who are as good as anything we would make here. Even in the US, anything we would make here, they're probably just as good. But the only problem is because if they're not licensed, you take the product with a grain of salt. One of the things when we first started our business, we were called Omega Alpha Pharmaceuticals, and we had the moniker Pharmaceuticals. We had jumped through the hoops to get our pharmaceutical manufacturing license. The reason at that time, a lot of people came to me and said, Gordon, you don't want to name pharmaceuticals because there's too much bad karma attached to pharmaceuticals, right? But at that time, there were no regulation. And I said, no, I like the word pharmaceutical because pharmaceuticals basically connotates that you've been blessed by Health Canada. One, people will badmouth the pharmaceuticals and say they control this, they control that, they want to own this, they want to own that. But you never, when you went out and you bought a Tylenol, ibuprofen, or any of those things, it never entered your mind, am I getting that quantity of ibuprofen, or am I getting that quantity of acetaminophen in your pill, right? It was a foregone conclusion was that you got what you're paying for. You got what was on the label, right? So that is why we wanted to remain a pharmaceutical company with a license, all right? Now, fast forwarding to today, the natural health product, because they give you a license, we do not need that pharmaceutical license anymore. And since we don't manufacture pharmaceuticals, that site license actually is a blessing to us in a way. It's a pain, but it's a good thing because it ensures quality for the end user.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you for coming on the show today to explain that.
Well, thank you, Jamie, for having me on.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
People just like you, with pain, inflammation, and mobility loss, are traveling to BioFlex Laser Therapy Clinic for treatment. The clinic is helping Canadians and patients from around the world move better, feel stronger, and live without limitations, all thanks to BioFlex Advanced Laser Therapy. If your goal is to reduce inflammation, relieve pain, and support recovery without medication, injections, or downtime, get to know BioFlexClinic.com. Trusted, non-invasive care.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Alex Snyder is a writer, facilitator, and former government strategist who bridges the worlds of mission-driven leadership and mindfulness. After spending more than 15 years inside high-pressure federal environments, along with a life-altering bike accident that reshaped his perspective on urgency and attention, he began questioning whether constant speed, pressure, and responsiveness were actually helping people live, lead, and relate more meaningfully. A meditation teacher and co-founder of Mindful Fed, Alex explores what modern busyness gives us and what it quietly takes away. In his book, Sometimes You Should Be Late, which is coming out in, or just came out actually, on July 7th, he holds degrees from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. And to learn more, you can go to slowmindfulness.com. Welcome to the show, Alex. How are you?
Thanks, Jamie. I'm doing quite well. It's nice to be with you.
So the pitch to me was, and I'm paraphrasing here, are you the type of person who gets easily frustrated in traffic jams, can't stand lineups, and is impatient when people are slow? And I checked all the boxes and I decided you needed to come on the show. So we're going to talk about people's relationship to time, which is something that I've been talking about quite a bit over the past couple of years, because I actually had a life-altering medical experience myself, and I'm looking at time very differently. We all recognize the version of ourselves that shows up when we're short on time. Why does feeling rushed seem to change not just what we do, but who we become?
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. It's a great question, because when we're rushed, it's sort of like when we're very hungry. There's part of us just feels a little bit unsettled, feels that the world in front of us is not the one that we want. And so we want to get through things. We want to get through our to-do list, hit the deadline. And so what happens is it activates this fear center of our brain. And in our modern world, that's saying efficiency, productivity, meeting the deadlines, being punctual, that's what matters. Our bodies shift into this different state that says, I'm at threat and I need to do something to fix that.
Talking about circumstances like traffic jams, airport security lines, flight delays, you see all of those as training grounds for our attention. Most people see those as wasted time. What's a guy like me missing when I react the way I do to those delays?
Yeah, Jamie, I'm laughing because it's so relatable, and I certainly feel that too. And when we are waiting for the airport line in traffic, especially if there's a sense of the stakes of it, it's so natural. And it's so natural for us to think about the world as we want it to be, this sort of idealized version where there's a parking spot right in front of the restaurant, where other drivers actually respect the rules of the road. And so it starts with understanding that it's really natural to be frustrated when the version of the world that we're seeing doesn't align with what we want. But what I offer in this book isn't saying that you're wrong, Jamie, for being frustrated by traffic, but that there's choice. And there's choice in how we respond to what the world gives us. It's a type of acceptance, you know, especially once you're already late for something, when you see the Google Map ETA tick up, when you're in that airport line, there's really nothing that you can do. We can either impatiently tap our toes, blame other people, think about how the world should have been designed differently, or we can remember that there's more to life than when we get places. And I'll just give you one example. So when you're traveling with your family in a car, let's say you want to get to a vacation spot or maybe the airport, there's this moment of, I want to get there to enjoy my time with my family at the beach, at the museum. But what I forgot for most of my life is I was already with my family. I was in the car, and that was a chance to say, okay, this traffic, it's exhausting, it's frustrating. I wish it were different. And I have a choice right now to enjoy the conversation with my family, to listen to some music. And part of the problem with our urgency culture, this world that focuses on punctuality, efficiency, doing, AI, everything, is we're forgetting what's possible if we allow our minds to zoom out and to remember what actually is a life well lived. And in my experience, it's not just frantic doing. It's about the quality of our attention, our presence.
So two people can experience the same set of criteria very differently, right? How much of our stress is really about the clock, and how much is it about the story that we're telling ourselves about time?
Yeah, I want to slow down with this question, because there's a risk of it getting very abstract. But the simple reality is that time is something that we construct. We build it as a culture, as individuals in family settings. And when we decide that meeting a friend for coffee at 10 o'clock, that getting there at 10:02 is a big problem, that is a decision that we're making. And that doesn't mean that time, as we structure it in our modern Western world of deadlines, of punctuality, that doesn't matter. Those items, those ideas, they serve purposes. But the thing is, they can also take us away from what really matters sometimes. And so when you talk about people experiencing time differently, I think what you're getting at is there are different ways to interpret the ways that we spend our days. And I'm sure you and other listeners have had the experience of having a weekend to-do list, which is just outside the realm of possibility. You'd have to break the space-time continuum to get through that to-do list. And in that moment, we have a choice. We can look at that list and feel deeply frustrated by what we can't do. Or we can say, okay, what are weekends for? What is this time for? And how do I want to inhabit that? And what I found coming from a very busy government career, coming from a very similar pattern, it sounds like you have, of wanting to do so much, is what do we lose when we think about time as only something to kind of get through really rapidly, to avoid wasting time, to spend it, versus something to move through and decide what we want to do with our weekend. And for me, what that's looked like was taking things off my to-do list. It's meant building in fewer activities when I'm visiting cities like Toronto or other places, because I realize what I'm losing out when time is something I have to like navigate very tightly, and instead finding a way to actually live my life in it, not always be running after it.
I see you in describing these things that are frustrating, lineups, traffic jams. I note that you're not personalizing it. They're just things that are happening. But when I'm experiencing them, it's always, why is that person not making their left-hand turn? Why are they not paying attention? Why is it that the light has turned green and they're not moving? Why is it that somebody is taking an extra amount of time talking to the person at the desk when there's a lineup of 20 people and we all just kind of want to move forward? For me, that's the frustration. I think a lot of the delay, the impingement on my time is from people who are completely disengaged with time. But you're basically saying we need to be less engaged with time. I'm not sure I can do that.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jamie, because you're asking exactly the right question. Why is that person, driving slowly by the road? Why are they taking that left-hand turn? And if we actually slow down enough with that question, the answer is most likely we have no idea. Talk about this in a work setting. How many times have, people sent these emails that are, as per my previous email, this very kind of impatient. When someone arrives at a meeting, you say something like, oh, nice of you to join us in a very sarcastic tone, as opposed to really welcoming someone. And you're talking about the why. Why is someone late? Why is someone talking to that person? We don't know. For example, maybe that person is talking to that person in the hotel check-in line because they're feeling really lonely, because they've had a death in their family and they just want to talk to someone. We don't know. And so my invitation isn't for you to think that you're a bad person for rushing, for wanting to get to that hotel to be checked in, but to sort of open up to what could be happening in those people's lives and where sort of empathy possible. And also for you, I mean, there's like the self-empathy, there's sort of this recognition, like, yeah, it's frustrating. And like, do you want to live your life in that line, tapping your toe and needing to go somewhere really quickly? Or do you want to say, okay, I'm in line. This is my life right now. Maybe that means I take a time to answer a couple emails. Maybe I look around and notice something in the space, or maybe, God forbid, like talk to the person in line and just ask them how they're doing and have one of those interactions that we know is so helpful for our health and well-being. And so it's all about saying that, Jamie, you have some agency in that moment, whether it's in traffic, in a line. And I'm kind of curious how that lands with you.
See, I think a lot of the delays, anytime I see a delay or dysfunction, I don't default to empathy. I really don't, because I don't believe the people who are causing the delays have any sense of empathy for others either. I think they're all wrapped up in whatever it is they're doing. The person that isn't paying attention in traffic is making traffic worse. The line at the airport in Houston because the Border Patrol hasn't been paid in 3 months and their work to rule is completely understandable as to how it came about. The person who is busy chatting when everybody else just wants to get help from the person at the desk is not really being mindful of everybody else who's around them. So I guess the question is, why should I be mindful if those people apparently aren't?
I love your question, Jamie, and I wanted to zoom out a second before I answer very directly. So my book is called Sometimes You Should Be Late, and it's not a book about slowing down for its own sake. I'm not saying that slowing is more virtuous than going fast. I'm saying that slowing down is something that gives us choice. So in those moments you're describing, when someone maybe really isn't thinking about the impact on other people, you're right. There is something that is morally there, that maybe that person has an obligation, a responsibility to think about, how am I affecting other people? And I might even add to that, that that effect on other people could be multiple. So for example, someone who takes the time to actually say hello to the ticket agent, ask them how their day is going, that actually might be something that's welcomed by that agent on a very busy, stressful day. So kind of point one. But going back to your initial point about sort of other people not thinking about you, being respectful for time of other people are other people, and we are we. I am me, you are you. And so the question isn't so much, and you're in the mindfulness space, you know about this, it's not so much, how can I make other people be better people? That's not a question that we can ask ourselves. It's, how do we be the best person that we can be? How do we reflect our values through our behavior and through our actions? And that ultimately is what I'm hoping this book invites people to do, to not try to remake the world, to not try to pretend that traffic or lines never exist, but to remember what's left in those moments is our individual choices. Do we turn towards empathy, compassion, grace, or do we go towards judgment, towards blame? And that's often, you know, I found it's not just blame towards others. I found it's blame towards ourselves. I imagine a lot of your listeners, and maybe even yourself, Jamie, have those moments of when we feel like we're letting people down because we're 5 minutes late, or we skip a deadline. And I think part of what I want to offer in this book is a sense of, there's more to life than when we arrive places. There's more to life on just how many things we do, how quickly we get to the front of that line. There's a deeper question of, how do we inhabit these short moments that we have on Earth?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't get to hear about possible steps that we could take to get to the place where you're at. Will you come back again and we can perhaps discuss that?
I'd love to.
Fantastic. That was Alex Snyder. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how the empty nest might be a fresh start on The Tonic. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Chantal Bisson is a best-selling author, parenting mentor, and lifestyle brand founder known for her empowering voice and raw authenticity. With her brand, Without Losing Your Cool, she's helped thousands of people navigate life, parenthood, trauma, and personal growth through real talk, personal storytelling, and practical tools. A mother of three, Chantal brings a lived experience to her books and podcast that makes you feel seen, heard, and inspired. Whether she's writing, speaking, or sharing daily insights, her mission is to help others break cycles, heal wounds, and live fully in their truth with hope for the future. Welcome to the show, Chantal. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on.
So today we're going to talk about something that is actually very near and dear to me, and that is what happens when you have an empty nest, which is actually quite fresh for me because we are technically, although, you know, kids drift in and out over time, empty nesters as of the last couple of weeks. So this is apropos.
Welcome to the club. Welcome to the club.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't want to be part of any club that would have me, but that's, you know, I hear what you're saying. So what does the concept of an empty nest mean to you? Is it simply when the last child physically leaves the home, or is it something else?
I love this question because for me, I found that the empty nest syndrome started long before the daughters actually all physically left. It starts in cycles, you know, in these little moments as they start to expand their society and their community and their away more, or they're traveling more. So they might still be under your roof. And as you said so perfectly, like they come in and out. It's not necessarily that all of a sudden, like back when I was a kid, once you moved out, you were out. You know, kids drift in and out of our homes for all the reasons that they do now in 2026. So for me, the empty nest syndrome started in like a trickle of not being needed as much for conversation, for that shoulder to lean on. There was always this transition of, oh, okay, there's a shift happening here in how my daughters need me to show up for them. And obviously the big empty nest is when you know the door has closed for the last time. Their footsteps are on the stairs, out the door, and the likelihood of them moving back in really, really sinks in and becomes your new reality.
Yeah. I mean, for years, you know, they'll go away to school and they'll come home for summers, or maybe they're saving money and they stay for a certain purpose. And then they all kind of react differently. And the youngest, which is typically the last one to leave, the difference in relationship between parents and the firstborn and their lastborn is so different. I mean, we're totally broken in. We're like old shoes by the time the last one leaves. So I hear you.
Exactly.
So when your kids leave, it's just you and your partner. I guess the trick is not to sort of expect your partner to fill the gaps that are now there because your kids are gone, right?
You know what? I talk about this ad nauseum in my book. The first book is Raising Your Kids Without Losing Your Cool. And I tackle this topic immediately. And that book was written for parents, like people who are couples and they're thinking about having children. And then, you know, they do get pregnant and the baby comes. And that book, Raising Your Kids Without Losing Your Cool, goes from the concept of we want to be parents. What does being parents look like to you? How do we want that to shape out? And then to age 10. And then parenting your teens is from 10 till you send them off to university. And the biggest thing I talk about in both of those books, which are parenting books, they are actually relationship books because so many people don't put the marriage, the partnership in front of the children. They go at it backwards. And when you get to the stage that you're talking about right now of that empty nest, when it's finally just you and your partner across from each other at the dinner table, if you have not romanced each other, if you have not made dates a priority, if you have not made showing up for your partner a priority, if you have made the children and their schedule and their interests and their needs come before the relationship, you are in for a rocky road. I'm not saying it's an impossible adjustment, but it will be a much more difficult adjustment to make when you have not given the nurturing and the commitment and the conversation and the intimacy to your partner for, you know, if you have three kids like we did, 37, 35, and now 29. Imagine if when we were pregnant with the first one 38 years ago, I kind of had put my husband on the back burner. By the time the baby left the nest, that's 25 solid years of not giving to the relationship, the primary relationship. And I say this in my books, it's like, you know, if you do a really good job at being a parent, those kids are going to leave and they will not come back. You are not going to have those children in your fold, in your home, your entire life, but you will your partner. So really prioritizing your partner is the key to making sure that the empty nest syndrome is not so challenging on the marriage, and that you also along that path, you are not just relying on your children to meet your emotional needs or keep you busy. Have a community, have hobbies, have interests, be outside of your role as parent, but also outside your role of being a partner. Nurture your entire self and being so that when the kids are gone, you have something interesting to bring to the table to one another. And you also have that built-in intimacy that you've been working on for 25 plus years.
But you also see this phase of the life as an opportunity. What does it look like, or what did it look like for you when you're back to living as a couple?
Well, interesting that you should say that. So my husband and I, we've been together since we were 18 years old.
Same.
Yeah. So you get it. So, you know, and we had kids really quickly. Like, we had our first daughter at 19. So we we did not have that alone time. We did not have that growing up together as a couple. We grew up together as parents. So it was even more important that we stayed on top of, hey, we are also a couple, but we are also individuals. How do we put all this in a pot, stir, and make a delicious stew rather than something that's inedible? And we, this year, in the winter, we did a 5-week road trip, he and I. Mm-hmm. And at about 2 weeks into that road trip, we looked at each other and we said, wow, it hit us both that this was the first time since being 18 years old that we spent more than 2 weeks alone together. Because obviously over the course of being a couple and a family for 37 years, we do the couple's holidays. You know, you go away for a week, you go away for 10 days. Sometimes if you're lucky, you can get a 2-week break, just the two of you. So this was the first time in all those years that we had spent more than 14 consecutive days, just he and I. And it was refreshing to see that we still liked each other.
Yeah, that was going to be that was going to be my next question, because everybody knows each other's shtick by this point, right? You know.
Yeah. And you know how to. I use the word manipulate, but you know how to maneuver around your partner when you've been in for almost 4 decades.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to see that we still had things to talk about. We had similar interests, and that we did like each other's company. We liked each other's company. It was a road trip. So, you know, we drove from Toronto all the way to Revelstoke, BC, and then drove all the way back home through the United States. And the thing that people need to get to in their intimate partnership is that it's okay to be in silence. I feel like so often partners feel like it needs to be, you know, a display of conversation and interest and excitement. And we need to get used to being okay in the moments of silence. And for us, it was, you know, we're driving for 5 straight days. So there were a lot of times where we were just quiet with one another and just enjoying being in each other's energy and just being alone together with our thoughts, but also just being at peace in the relationship. And the key to getting there is being sure that within all of the time that goes by, and certainly when you find yourselves alone, is reconnecting to one another, like getting back to understanding your partner as a human, not as a father or as a mother.
Agreed. Let's shift gears and talk about the relationship with your kids once they've left. So I'm fortunate. All my kids live in the city. And we, you know, we see them, and I see them probably every week. They come for dinner on Friday every week.
Oh, I love that.
So what do you do to stay connected with your kids?
Well, I'm going to tell you, this is kind of crazy and weird, but so our two daughters, the middle and the youngest, live 2 blocks away from us.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll be home and we'll be having a morning coffee sitting around our house. And then the door opens and in runs the corgi and the little rescue. And we're like, oh, the girls are here. And we'll have coffee. You know, sometimes we'll be walking in our neighborhood on an evening walk and there are our daughters walking their dogs. So it's quite easy. And there's not a whole lot of scheduling around it. And our eldest daughter is in Ottawa with her husband and our grandson. So that requires a little more, you know, focused energy on ensuring that that relationship continues to be nourished and continues to be a priority, both for her and I. You know, we both have to put in the effort. But all three of our daughters, and this, obviously, I appreciate that this is not the norm, but you know, my husband's an actor and I own a marina and I have my Without Losing Your Cool brand. So our daughters all work for the family companies. So we're also in communication with them as bosses and employees and coworkers. So, and that is a little tricky because, again, you're in a relationship with your grown children where you have to listen and understand that you've hired them for their expertise. And you got to take your mom hat off when they're giving you direction on what they believe is best for the companies. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we have very interesting relationships with our girls. And to your point that your kids are in the city, we are so blessed that our two do. But with the one who lives apart, it really, and you know, I find this interesting because I used to remember, as I was becoming an adult, why doesn't my mom call me more? And as a mother now to adult children, I catch myself being like, why don't my girls call? And I'm like, well, you as a daughter would like your mom to call you more. So now you're the mother to the daughters. Why don't you call your daughters more? You know, so it's a conscious involvement to my relationship with them where I am saying, okay, yes, we're texting. Texting is an easy way to communicate. We're sending reels back and forth. But when was the last time I picked up the phone and called? And it's that reminder to be the one who puts out the extension of, I love you. I'm thinking of you. You're on my mind by actually calling, you know, and not expecting your children to come to you, which I believe is a very tricky thing with parents because there is that expectation in the back of our minds, whether we want to admit it or not, where it's like, well, you know, I did all the hard work when they were little. Now they can give back. No, put your ego aside and be the one who lets your children know, I'm still here. I love you. I'm thinking about you. And just pick up the phone and get that voice-to-voice connection or even video, FaceTime. Just be the one.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
I loved it. I look forward to coming back.
That was Chantal Bisson. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss access to medication on The Tonic. You already know the importance of exercise for energy, improved strength, and better mobility. What you really need is an expert to show you how to exercise safely. Receive personalized coaching from Fitness Solutions Plus. Learn safe exercises for osteoporosis, diabetes, chronic pain, and balance issues from a fitness specialist. For a free consultation, visit fitnesssolutionsplus.ca, number one in one-on-one fitness for adults over 50.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Lisa McColeman is a retired teacher of nearly 30 years, a lifelong community volunteer, and co-owner of a family farm near Fergus, Ontario, where she and her husband have lived and worked for more than two decades. She's the proud mother of four children and grandmother of three grandsons. Lisa was diagnosed with pediatric onset hypophosphatasia, otherwise known as HPP, a rare genetic bone disease at the age of 52. She's sharing her experience to help raise awareness of the condition and her fight for access to treatment that she needs to survive. Dr. Rick Adachi is an emeritus professor of medicine at McMaster University and one of Canada's leading experts in osteoporosis and bone health. He has authored more than 650 peer-reviewed publications and is internationally recognized for his contribution to osteoporosis research and clinical care. His work has earned numerous national and international awards, including honors from Osteoporosis Canada and the International Osteoporosis Foundation. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Lisa, I understand it took more than 50 years to finally receive a diagnosis of HPP. Looking back, what was the journey like, and what did it mean to finally have a name for what you're living with?
Okay. Well, as a child, I really knew no different than the life I was living. But looking back now, I see I had a lot of respiratory problems. I was very clumsy, uncoordinated, had poor teeth and many fractures. I grew up in a home where you did not complain, and so there was no space for pain nor injuries. So I remember that I was told that I had low alkaline phosphatase levels and low bone density when I was in my adult years. I had doctors wondering out loud, like, what could it be? But it wasn't until Dr. Adachi took me on that he was able to finally diagnose me with HPP.
And what, now that you know what you have, what does that mean to you?
So knowing that knowing what I have, my first thought was for my children, honestly, as it's a rare genetic bone disorder. And I remember being in the car after Dr. Adachi giving me the diagnosis and actually Googling it to try and figure out like what could I possibly have passed on to my kids. But thankfully, they were tested and none of them have hypophosphatasia. So initially I had, phew, the kids are fine. I had hope that knowing what I had would be the first step to healing. But unfortunately, that hope is disappearing with each denial.
Dr. Adachi, HPP is a rare disease that many people have never heard of. Can you explain what it does to the body and why an early diagnosis and timely treatment can make such a big difference?
Well, as you pointed out, HPP is a serious genetic disease that leads to poor mineralization of bone. And as a result of that, we see fractures and muscle weakness. It can also affect the kidneys, with calcification of the kidneys, kidney stones, and in children, poor lung function and seizures. As a result, early diagnosis and treatment is essential in preventing these types of complications. For Lisa, we're advocating for treatment to prevent further fractures and to help with the muscle weakness and the accompanying fatigue. For Lisa, this would mean that she would have to live with less pain, with better muscle function and with less fatigue. It would improve her quality of life. When we think of fractures, we think of typical drugs for osteoporosis like the bisphosphonates and denosumab. Unfortunately, these drugs do not work in HPP and, in fact, may increase the risk of having further fractures, like fractures of the thigh bone and stress fractures of the feet. As a result, the only therapy that we have for HPP is this drug called Strensiq.
Lisa, despite finally getting the diagnosis, you found yourself in a position of knowing there's an approved treatment available, but being unable to access it because of Ontario's funding criteria. How did you react when you learned that your age and not your medical need was the reason that the request was denied?
How did I react? Oh man, there were lots of tears, tears of frustration and anger. First, I felt frustration that there was a treatment available, but I was being denied it because of my age. That just felt discriminatory. There was frustration that Dr. Adachi had been applying for years for me to get on this treatment, and meanwhile, my body continues to deteriorate, as Dr. Adachi mentioned, with more fractures and more pain. Honestly, I've tried to keep hoping that if we just talked to the right person, that they would see that my life was worth saving and that it would be approved. Strensiq is the only option for me, so looking at pain management now is what my other specialists have offered, but nothing seems to be working. I'm going to lose more and more of myself with every fracture, and the pain's only going to get worse. And, that's a terrifying and dark space to live in. I've been holding on to hope, but also the reality that if I don't get Strensiq, I have to prepare for the future. And that means I've had to have really tough conversations with my family. I've been told by my medical team of specialists to prepare an advanced care directive, and respecting my choice, a palliative care doctor has been brought onto the team to now help navigate MAID for me. With Strensiq, I have a life. Without it, basically, it's a death sentence.
Dr. Adachi, you've prescribed Strensiq for Lisa and requested an exceptional review, which was denied. From a physician's perspective, what message does that send when clinical judgment and patient's individual circumstances don't seem to be enough to secure access to an approved treatment?
I found this really, really very frustrating. We as physicians, we take a look at the science and we take a look at all the work that's been done to help us understand why people develop HPP. We then go on to develop therapies for conditions which we thought we would never have a therapy for. And then we're elated when something becomes available. And then we go through the frustration of trying to get that therapy for our patients. And only, when we are denied over and over again, does it become even more frustrating. And you really get quite angry. I find it particularly frustrating when we sent numerous letters to the government and to the Minister of Health explaining the dire circumstances that Lisa is living under, and to receive the same form letters declining our request over and over again makes you wonder if they've even read the requests that we've made.
Yeah. Lisa, you know, you mentioned about the pain and the fractures that don't heal properly and how it's impacting your independence. What does a typical day look like for you now, and how's the disease changed your life?
Oh, wow. Perhaps the best way to tackle that would be to think about, like, what was my life before these last fractures? And, you know, I was really an active person. I was active on the farm. Our farm is very busy, so I'm active taking care of animals, feeding chickens. I could lift 50-pound bags of feed. I was throwing bales in the mow with my kids. Every day I started with exercise, and that was a big part of my mental health and my physical health for me. I wanted to grow strong, be strong as I grew older. I could hug my grandchildren and lift them up, and I had a big part in childcare with our older grandchildren in their younger years, and I was able to run and play with them. At the end of the day, Rob and I would go out and socialize. I was active in the community, and we had just started traveling in our retirement. Now, what is the world like? Since I experienced the last three compression fractures in my spine, my days all start the same. It's pain meds, and then a heated pad and a chair are needed. I can no longer lift up my grandchildren, and for that matter, I've never ever lifted up my youngest grandson. I've had to give up most of my volunteering. My world is getting smaller and smaller. I can't get a proper hug or give a proper hug. I have to stretch out, lay down multiple times a day. So I feel like my world is bed to chair to outside, maybe on the porch. It's isolating and lonely to deal with this. And realizing that people don't want to hear that what I need, I'm being denied by the government. They don't want to think of our government that way. And many people just don't want to listen to that. For me, sleep is a big thing. I have opioids that are helping me sleep at night. I've been given permission to increase them during the day, but I'm holding out because I'll lose what little independence I have left. You know, I used to be able to put my head down, persevere, work hard, and I would be able to get things done. Now, if I push myself too hard, I lose more ground. So I struggle with feeling useless and not being able to pull my weight here on the farm. Physically, I've lost almost 4 inches of height over the past year, and it's impacted all parts of my body. I need a walking pool or my service dog now all the time so I don't fall. You know, and I've had an amazing team of specialists trying to help and support me on this journey. And we've tried everything that's been suggested. I can no longer look forward to traveling. Life's becoming smaller and smaller, and I live in fear of the next fracture. And with every fracture, I'll lose more height. I'm going to cause more problems. And it's hard to be hopeful in that world without Strunswick. With Strunswick, it's a totally different world. And I would actually have a future. So in short, my life's been totally changed with hypophosphatasia. Without Strunswick, I will die a slow, painful death where I'm going to lose my ability to walk. Breathing's going to get harder and everything will be harder. And I will be totally dependent on my husband. And that does not sound fair.
Yeah, I'm very sorry about that. Lisa, we have time for one last question. And that is, if you had the opportunity to speak directly to the decision makers responsible for funding this treatment, what would you want them to understand, not just about your case, but what it means to have timely access to treatment or could mean for people living with rare diseases in Ontario?
Thank you for that chance. I would say, Minister Jones, you know, I realize that I am only one of many Ontarians for whom you're responsible for each day. But my name is Lisa. I'm a 58-year-old retired teacher, farmer, wife, and mom, and grandma. I've worked hard all my life striving to meet everyone's needs in my family and the community, trying to give more than I ask. This is really tough. I love the life that we built together with sweat and tears. Being diagnosed with hypophosphatasia and then denied the life-saving treatment has been devastating, not only for me, but my husband and children. I've received no support from the local MPP, nor any luck with the Ministry of Health. As it stands right now, my children are going to grow up into their adult years without me. My grandchildren will grow up not knowing me, and my husband and best friend will be without me, and he's going to be heartbroken. Knowing Strensiq is successful treatment for my rare disease, but being denied it is cruel and inhumane. Being offered advanced care support to help me die rather than the treatment I need to live is absolutely too brutal to accept. It's a deeply disturbing message to Ontarians that this is the state of our present healthcare system. And I ask that you consider me and folks like me with rare diseases who need specific treatments to live and what our lives are truly worth. Thank you.
So sorry. Thank you both for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, Alex Snyder, Chantal Bisson, Lisa McColeman, and Dr. Rick Adachi. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter with content curated personally by me will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin, wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.